I'm very happy now to welcome Barbara Garson. She's a journalist, playwright, and author, and her new book is Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So this is a book of stories about all kinds of people in the United States, and it's the sort of post-2008 recession, and they're living and surviving in a whole lot of different ways. And taken together, they paint a picture of a nation in real trouble, at least from the perspective of the 99%. How did you
begin? And I'd say
begin
one that was in trouble before.
Right, exactly.
That's one of the things I found about most people, that the whole recession and their personal problems came from the fact that their incomes had been stagnant, their security had been decreasing for the last 40 years, they or their parents.
So this is what I was wondering about. I mean, there's a phenomenon that started about 40 years ago that you call the Great Reversal. What is that? How did it happen?
Well, starting in the 70s, I wrote my first book about American working people in the 1960s. That gives you some sense how old I am. And we and they, people on assembly lines, were striking about speed of the line, we're talking about, auto workers, union auto workers, we're talking about young people, of course, and Vietnam vets, we're talking about whether they should make better cars, whether they should make fewer cars, we're actually discussing that as if the productivity was increasing greatly and as if the fruits of their productivity was for them to decide what to do with. And in the meantime, employers were getting very upset because young Vietnam veterans who they thought would work very hard were not coming in on Mondays and Fridays. I mean, jobs were around. Not great jobs, but you could always quit. If you liked a band in some other city, I'm not talking about the late 1960s, and get another rent-paying job. And it's at that point that employers started moving work overseas. And lowering wages by every possible means, and with the total cooperation of both parties, I might say, in the government, various laws that allowed you to move tax-free, laws that made it easy to transfer money essentially to wealthier people, and that started in the 70s. There's a lot of debate among people who know whether that's because, in fact, profits were starting to go down. We had been the unique producer since World War II, and now there were other countries rebuilding. Or whether it was because the politics enabled them to, because the lessons of the 1930s had been forgotten. In other words, did they do it because they had to, or did they do it because they could?
Right.
But in any case, they did it. And our wages started declining and productivity increased enormously. I mean, productivity increased almost 100% and wages stayed stagnant or declined about 4% over those years since then. And that means we produced a lot more than we could sell to each other. And that's what America largely does. We sell about 70% of what we produce to each other. So suddenly, basically, people couldn't buy what they produced. And even the production overseas was being made by even poorer workers. They certainly weren't going to buy the televisions and the $50 sneakers they were working on. So my theory that I had before, I have to admit, but that seemed to be so obvious when I started talking to people who'd lost jobs or income during the recession, was that essentially employers said, I have an idea. Instead of paying them enough to buy what they produce, I'll lend them the money to do it. And that led to one series of debt crises after another, the last one of which was the brilliant idea that, I'll lend money to people to buy houses they can't afford, and I'll give them huge mortgages that they can't possibly pay off, but I'll get them off my books somehow. And it was literally the same companies. I mean, General Motors became General Motors Acceptance Corporation, started out lending money just to, give people help in buying General Motors cars. And before you know it, they were making more money on lending than they were making on making cars. And very soon, I mean, they were one of the largest firms that had to be bailed out on the mortgage crisis. Same thing with GE. So in other words, they thought they could go on forever. Or maybe nobody thought about it. Maybe that's the problem. There was some sense that one could go on forever paying people less and less money to produce more and more. And somehow we'd lend them the money to buy it. Or somehow, okay, they couldn't buy anything, but I'd be making more money anyway because I'd be getting, you know, more profits out of it because I'd be selling the stuff still. And yeah, I mean, you know, profits were rising. But the general production wasn't increasing, just profits out of a smaller production or stagnant production was increasing. So, and that led to the big crisis. And it bore out in each individual, too. Well, not in every individual. I mean, that it wouldn't be a very honest book or a very interesting one if every single person just illustrated a point. But generally, when I started talking to people, it seemed like they or their parents had gotten into debt, or they just assumed that they could pay back their college loans out of jobs, but the jobs weren't really there. And then if you did the calculation, there was no way they could pay that money back.
Well, that's the thing that makes all of this such a Ponzi scheme or pyramid scheme, which is that if you are not paying people enough to live, and then you're lending them money to get by, and you can't ever pay that money back because you're not being paid enough to live, eventually it has to come crashing down. That's just the laws of mathematics.
And the odd, or I wouldn't say the odd thing, but most recessions, depressions, they're cruel, but they start the process all over again. They usually involve a certain amount of redistribution. This one hasn't, so you can be sure the next one is coming soon. Because normally, this might sound funny to you, but normally in the course of a recession, during the recession, businesses keep their central staff so that they have the people that can, you know, they keep the know-how. They put some people on part-time. They let some people go. They compete by taking lower prices. They do, in fact, take lower profits during a recession. And generally during a recession, the amount of the total production, which of course is down, but the percentage that's of the profit that's realized in the percentage of the production that's realized in profit, in money that goes to investors, is down. And the percentage that goes into wages usually goes up. And gradually, you know, things readjust themselves. This time, that never happened. That never, ever happened. From 2008 to 2011, the percentage that went in profits kept increasing. And now I look at the people that I looked at during the recession, and I see that many of them haven't gotten jobs again. But if they got their old jobs back, they would be worse jobs. And I don't mean just about factory work. Like, I talked to four kids in New York. Kids, I say. Oh, how can I say that? Four Seinfeld-age kids, you know, some fluctuating in the course of the series between, you know, 40 and 50 kids. But they had no children. They lived in Manhattan, and they had incomes of around $50,000. Which you wonder about Seinfeld people, how they kept up those apartments. These people put all their money into rents and to enjoying the city, and they were single. And they had skilled jobs. One person did computer graphics for textbook layout. Another was an insurance adjuster. Another was an editor on a trade magazine. Another did, I guess I could say now, she did accounts payable for a big comedy network, well, for a big network. And they lost their jobs. They met in church, as a matter of fact. They realized in church that they were all unemployed. It happened to be a Wiccan church, but still. And they started a pink slip club. They thought they'd keep each other company and enjoy the city during the days, which they never had a chance to do, for the few weeks until they found another job. Well, they never found other jobs. I've been following them from 2008. I keep it up on a website, what's happening to them and the other people that I meet. And here's the thing, again, I'll say different than other recessions. People like them, who started so optimistically, and they're just funny people. They're nicer than Seinfeld people. I have to say that about them. They're helpful to each other. And, you know, people like that, the individuals probably will never, 15 years later, the statistics show from previous recessions, these individuals will not be at the level they would have been predicted to be in terms of income or job security. That was individuals. But other people will have those jobs. But look what happened to these people's jobs. While they had been laid off, from a couple of them from completely profitable companies, the one who did a textbook editing graphics, his company makes the, you can't call it educational textbooks. They make that junk, that testing junk, those testing series that goes out on computers and in tech and in little workbooks to school districts all over the country. They make a fortune, and that was the one thing these poor beleaguered school districts didn't cut out. So the company never lost money during the recession, but they fired all these people, and gradually the guy that I know who claims, he says, oh, I'm still unemployed, but he gets a little piecework here and a little piecework there. And I said, well, you might be working for the same company. And he said, well, not really, because the people there tell me that they're sending my part of the job overseas now. But whether it's overseas or to part-timers here, that's not only what happened to him, but it's what happened to the job. In other words, what went on before is continuing to go on. It's not like, okay, we're gradually going back up to where we were before. That's the classic. I mean, I have to say, it's sad to say normal recession, normal depression, but the truth is they are normal. They're part of capitalism, whether you like it or not. But this one is just a continuation of the same pattern that led it into us. Or another lady I met, she's in the book too, and she works in a fancy women's store who has its flagship store on Madison Avenue in New York. I mean, it's one of these places you don't shop in, where you walk in and her customers would come in every season and say, oh, what have you got for me this year? You know what I like. And she really cared about clothing people. I mean, now that she's out of work, she actually volunteers for a project that collects clothing and dresses women who have various problems and are going back out into the labor market, you know, been in shelters and stuff. And she loves finding clothing for them. When she interviewed me, she looked right away at me. She said, one pair of black pants, and you could wear those old thrift suits, but, you know, that thrift store jacket and stuff like that. We could tie it together. Wait, she said, when we have a sale on petites, I'll call you. Well, she's working in this store, which is very fancy, a name brand you would know, and I'm going to give you, not going to name it because she's still working there, but they cut everybody's hours down. Okay, it's a recession. They're cutting hours down. But they also made the hours unscheduled. I mean, every 2 weeks they tell you what your hours will be for the next 2 weeks.
So there's no predictability.
No predictability, or very little. I mean, it depended on how much they liked you and you knew them that you could say, look, I can't come in the afternoons. You know, I have a doctor's appointment 2 weeks from now. But she said to me when I first interviewed, I said, well, you know, that is what happens during a recession, but they try to retain the core staff. She said to me, but take a look. While this is happening, they're hiring new people. She said, so I don't think it's true that they're just trying to keep us all till the end of the recession. And boy, was she right. Soon they told them that they had no more benefits. And that these people were professionals. You would think of salespeople as, oh, you know, come and go. They had benefits. She had been, one time, she had been the company's largest commission receiver. For several years, she won that prize, the best sales lady, you might say, in terms of the commission she received. These commissions were higher than their salaries. I mean, they're selling, you know, thousands of dollars of clothing to people who walk in, individuals each season. So all of that was gone. Commission was gone. Hours were gone. It's now a job that is, she said, maybe you could, you were going to college, and this fit, it fits your schedule this term, you take it, and then quit it next term. And eventually they called the whole staff together and told them that if they left voluntarily, they wouldn't contest their unemployment insurance. In other words, they wouldn't say, oh, you quit. They take it as fired, and so that and your unemployment insurance and a very small separation money was used as a kind of severance.
Right.
And everybody left but her. She said everybody of the old staff left but her because she herself was older, her husband was retired, and she said, I just like to come out of my house and see my old clients. But the point I'm making is that it's not just that the women who left have had a setback. That job isn't fair as a prestige job, as a high-paying job. Nobody's going to have that job.
Exactly.
This whole group of people is pushed down, not because their work has become less skilled, but because they do it because they can. And this is not a case of foreign competition because this particular... Well, I take that back. I was about to say this store has no competition in its area. But no, you could bring in other stores and other products. But the educational testing company had no competition. This is it. They just do it. And there's no bottom. There's no too low to go. But for each company. But there is too low for the whole company, the whole country, and I don't mean just because of the suffering. I mean, people like my books because I do well in bringing forth these people. By the way, they're not all sad sacks by any means. But American poor people are, in a very strange way, richer than poor people in other countries. I mean, none of the people I talk to. To me, stopping in and buying coffee, I know you run a cafe, but stopping in and buying coffee for $2-3 seems strange to me. I'm old. But nobody that I talked to carried a thermos. I mean, they still kept up a certain living standard, but they had no security. Their pensions were all being spent. They didn't know where anything was coming from next. It was very interesting to me to talk to people because it wasn't just sad sacks or people in misery, but all the security is gone.
Exactly. We're talking to Barbara Garson about her book, Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession. And first of all, the people who you introduce us to are very vivid characters. You like them. They're people you'd like to get to know, so a lot of them or spend time with.
Oh, but thank you, I do like that.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, I... You feel like you know them. You kind of get a sense of what they look like visually. And there's some people you meet in the Midwest, and this hippie guy and his conservative father. But what you're painting is a picture of a nation in decline that has written off us ordinary people, not only as workers, as you say, but also as consumers. So basically, ordinary people, the 99%, simply don't matter anymore.
And you said something. You said a nation in decline. Now, it's a funny thing. There was a time when it was like it was the left that was saying the empire was declining. Whether we were saying it or not, the rest of the country would take, say, the anti-movement and say, oh, they don't care if America wins or America's in decline or, you know. But now, it's a funny thing. It is exactly as you said. It is the, do I dare say, ruling class? It's the investing class, let's put it that way. It's the investing class, people who do not make the basis of their money on a salary that comes in every week, high or low. It's the investing class that is saying this country's on a decline, and that includes many politicians. For instance, I heard George Bush's brother, the governor of Florida, say that at a meeting. Well, America's in decline. Most of them don't say it exactly that way, but it's they that are writing off the country. They are saying, yeah. We have no need for most of these people as workers. We have no need for most of these people as consumers. If you look at a big company and they're trying to do some kind of sales pitch about their stock, they'll tell you about their possibilities overseas. But I'll tell you something. If they get their way, their possibilities overseas won't be very good either, because they're so busy fighting to keep wages down there, too. You know, wages actually went down after NAFTA in Mexico, industrial wages. And yet our jobs went to them. There were more industrial jobs. I don't mean to say that, but the industrial wage on the average went down. So it's like, it's a new ball game to me. I mean, you know, if you're some kind of old liberal or Keynesian, and you think, yeah, these crashes happen, and then we put money back into the economy, and then it'll go back up, and I don't know where it's going to go.
Well, that's a question. A couple of questions arise as a result of that. I mean, you talk about like the graph of what's happening, and most recessions or depressions are either a V-shaped curve where it dips down and comes right back up, or a U-shaped curve where it dips down and kind of stays down for a while and then comes back up. And right now, we have an L-shaped curve where...
That's new. I think I made that up. I don't hear other economists talking about L-shaped.
Yeah, and so you wonder, like, what the... Well, first of all, okay, they've written us off, and if they write off the whole world as workers, there will be nobody to buy anything, and you have this oligarchy unlike anything ever known to humankind. But I keep wondering as I look at this.
Now, remember, though, there's one hope. I mean, Occupy is right, and I'm right. I mean, in my heart, I'm really not just a Keynesian, but a socialist. And when you see that, the stuff is still there. I mean, to say there is enough to house us all. There is enough to feed us all, probably with much less labor, and to house us with using up much less stuff than we used to do, because we have all kinds of wonderful new materials and they're easy to prefabricate. And we can take care of ourselves. We just have to think of something different than the I want to call it the market system, but it was than the market system in which capital has to get its take, has to get its big share. If we want, I mean, it's not as if we are doomed to suffer, because, you know what I mean, there is some way out of this. It's not some way that people are going to step back and say, well, okay, maybe we have to make it a little less capitalist. I mean, they're not going to say it, but it, you know.
Well, there are, as you point out in the end of the book, redistributions within capitalism. And they happen sometimes during depressions, like the New Deal was a form of redistribution.
Yeah, like, you know, I'm surprised that I have to talk about that. I mean, mostly, look, a smart kid, if you have a kid who's playing Monopoly with his parents, and he's starting to get all the money and all the houses and all the hotels, and he wants to keep playing up at past bedtime, he can see that the more he gets, the more he gets. So he'll start cheating and slipping money to his parents' side so the game can keep going. And that's something that I expected to happen here. We had a Democratic president who fashioned himself a kind of new dealer, and I expected that that would happen. Not that it didn't require me to have to make it happen either. Right. And I'm so startled that it hasn't. I'm so startled that there has been as little redistribution as there has. And by the way, in a way, there's been a little more in the United States than in Europe. That's startling, too. They have more built in. They have better unemployment and all that. That kicks in immediately. But when it came to a real stimulus, we have had more stimulus than they had in Europe, although in Europe they have some automatic stimuluses that are greater than ours. That is the amount of unemployment you get and the weeks that you get it for. That's a stimulus. But when it came to the big stimulus bills, they got crazy about austerity. The United States did a little more in the way of stimulus, but so little compared to what was needed. I mean, think that the New Deal during the Depression put 11 million people to work in a much smaller economy, put them on the payroll. And And we all love the post offices they built. And here in New York, we've got so many beautiful things from the New Deal. And maybe some of it was leaf raking, as people made fun of. I don't know. Maybe it's good to rake leaves. I don't know. I never understood why people rake their leaves instead of just leaving them on the ground. But what would you know in Arizona about leaf raking? Or in New Mexico, what would you know about leaf raking? But anyway,
we have leaves here. We have fall.
Oh, okay. Oh, I'm sorry. I am sorry to be a Eastern chauvinist.
No, but I mean, I want to go back to a couple of other points that I think are really important to bring up that speak to where we are today. Because you have a level of greed and arrogance on the part of companies that are eliminating full-time jobs, eliminating jobs with benefits, eliminating commissions, eliminating well-paid jobs. You have fewer tenured jobs in universities. You have people struggling and patching together a life to survive.
First, in a way, I mean, it was 40 years ago that somebody invited me to teach playwriting, and I said, on one course, and I said, that would be scabbing. And they said, oh, well, it's just playwriting. That's very special. We need to find a special person. I'm only giving one course. And I wrote an article joking about it. I said, soon they'll be teaching English 101 that way.
Right. And that's what actually happened. But here's the thing. When you have that kind of a situation where instead of paying people, companies are paying them too little and then lending money to them, which they can never pay back, you also have another part of the picture, which is that people rely more on government subsidies, which are food stamps, subsidized housing, whatever bit of safety net we have. And basically what these are corporate subsidies. They're subsidizing corporations so that they don't have to pay a living wage.
Well, you know, that's true. And I don't know what to say about it. I don't want to take away those subsidies, but maybe we should, you know, tax people for them. When I think about the New York subways, how would Wall Street work if people couldn't come to work by subway? Right. Companies should pay a percentage for those services that bring people to them, or that I'd rather have wages go up than say, well, you have to pay more in food stamps because so many of your workers are on food stamps. But
so, what is, and this is a question that kept on coming up for me as I was reading your book, it's hard to fathom what the economy really is. I mean, all economies are grounded in real things, like plants and animals and minerals that you take out of the water or the ground or whatever. But we have an economy where money makes money and it's disconnected from reality, and the people who are sort of churning this money around are disconnected from reality.
I hope that some of that gets explained in the course of the whole book, because I wrote a book before it, Money Makes the World Go Around, that was looking at the global economy. And there, too, I said, I'm going to follow my money around the world. And I took my book advance and I put it in a little nice bank, and they had nothing to do with it in that town, so they gave it to Chase. And I tried to follow real things, because that's what banks traditionally said that they were about. I give a loan to a businessman, and he builds us something, and he pays. And capital is important. He pays the workers before the business is making money, so that's why he needs my money. But then he gets it built, and he makes something, and he can pay me back. And I tried to find loans that illustrated that, and I couldn't. And I kept saying, I must be something I don't understand. I don't understand how this can keep going. But that's what happens when money accumulates in fewer and fewer hands. Problem with capital is you can't put it under your mattress. You know, everybody's talking about inequality now. That may be unpleasant and unnice, but it isn't deadly if it means I have $1 million and I buy a yacht and you have $100 and you go by subway. That may be unfair, but it's not deadly. But when they talk about inequality, remember what they're talking about is not I have $1 million or $10 million, but my income goes into the bank and it goes into the brokerage firm, and they invest it. They have to invest it. A bank can't keep its money in the bank. So the bank, when money accumulates in fewer and fewer hands, it becomes investment money. That happens whether individuals get big salaries or whether companies like General Motors are making big profits but not making more cars. So they can't invest back in car making, so they put their money in the bank, or they become a bank. The bank must do something with it. I mean, they can't pay you interest, however small, if the bank keeps its money in the bank. The federal government subsidizes them sometimes by saying, okay, you can keep the money in our bank and we'll give you interest and you don't have to do anything with it. You'll buy government bonds. But basically, the money has to go out somewhere. That's capitalism. And capitalism has a big spin. And when a country is empty and railroads have to be built, then those big fortunes actually do something. They usually a pretty mean time, but it's capitalism as Marx saw it. Very dynamic, mean, but fantastically dynamic. Now we have a situation where to produce much more like that is deadly to the planet. Also, we've accumulated money in so few hands that we can't make that much more for people. Now, I'm not saying there aren't any real needs, but to sell to them, that capital, it's not the inequality that's deadly, it's how much of it is in the form of capital. When you have a lot of money, you don't have a big income. You have investment money, and that money is really very dangerous right now. And so if a bank has it and it has to invest it, they'll get into those schemes that, in retrospect, look so ridiculous. You say, what? He's a banker? He's so smart? He's so smart and he decided to lend money to people for houses that they couldn't possibly pay back unless the house value itself doubled each year, and then they would just borrow more money out of the house to pay me back. I mean, that's crazy. Right. And anybody can see it's crazy. But the bank has to do something with the money. We forget how desperate they are because they're so calm and cool when they go up to the Senate committee. And they are smart in the sense that they pass the risk on to somebody else. In that sense, I guess they are smart and they're powerful. But they can't get around the fact that they must keep lending that money.
Well, this is the thing that I wanted to ask you about. There's a really interesting chapter where you have a banker who has been unemployed and you interview him, and one of the things that he did and did very well was give mid-level loans to people who were doing actually productive things. Like, this is the kind of thing that you were looking for.
Now, mid-level loan doesn't mean, you know, to a nail polishing salon. It meant these customers were like 10 million to, was it what they took in, 10 million to 50 million a year.
Right. And so, but that is, you know, a kind of small to medium sized business. And in order to make a loan like that, you have to actually look very carefully at who this person is and what they're doing with it and make a judgment. But those companies do productive things. And what we have now is a situation where the big, big banks don't want to make those kinds of loans, so the people who actually need them can't do their business. And now money is just sort of circling in this vortex of disconnection from productive.
There were two reasons why his part of the bank was going down. First, as you say, there wasn't much prestige attached to those loans. But if you lent to a very huge company, you could syndicate the loan. You could lend billions to AT&T, if they should need billions, and sell the loan off in little pieces to other people because they knew what AT&T was. Or vice versa, he said. At the low end, you could package up loans to people no one knew, but you said this is a statistically balanced package, which we know is the securitization of mortgages or student loans or credit card debt or auto loans. And supposedly on some statistical basis, this was a safe loan. His loan began to lose prestige in the bank because it was the type of loan, as you say, that you knew the customer, and that was the basis, and you knew his business, and that was the basis of knowing it was safe, and you had to hold the loan on the books as the man paid you back. That was a very profitable way if the man paid you back, and even if you had a normal amount of failures, it was still very profitable over the years. But if you did the other thing, if you securitized the loan and sold off the pieces, then you got another big pile of money right away, and you could lend that. But who are you going to lend it to? His small businessman, he said, he reminded me that the bank did want him to make his loans while he was still employed there. But his small businessman wasn't going to borrow any money unless he got orders. He wasn't borrowing because the bank could lend to him. He wasn't borrowing because he liked to build a new factory. He was borrowing. He'd only borrow when the orders came in. Right. Then he would borrow to buy the materials for next year's production. So he needed real business. And the real business wasn't expanding, or it was in only a few things. It was a combination. The real business wasn't expanding. And then the second factor, because remember, I'm talking to individuals. At a point, he was asked to go into investment banking, and he didn't make the break. And he remembers that as a very marginalizing time in his life when he became rooted in what became the backwaters of banking, which was, we would think of as real banking, lending money to people who need it to produce something.
Right.
Even if that production is a service. I don't want to give the impression that shoes are real and airline reservations aren't, but whatever it was that he was producing. And yes, he became the backwater. That was very interesting, the period that the man could recall, the period when he made... It's funny, I'm combining personal stories. This is a man who I respected a lot, but every once in a while... This is the man who didn't have time to see me, and then one day called and said, on a Sunday night, can you see me Monday? Can you see me tomorrow? Do you have time for lunch tomorrow? And when we finally got together, he did reveal that his family can survive on his wife's income. She's in the same kind of business he was. But come Sunday night, the children are getting ready for school, his wife is getting ready for work, and what is he supposed to do the next day? And he gets scared sometime. It's that, you know, existential angst. Who is he? What is he? And he tells me a lot about his father and when... Well, anyway, but it's personal, and at the same time, he's telling me about banking because he can remember the moment when he made the choice that put him into the backwater of banking. And just as you say, what we think real banking is, lending for some production, became the backwater. And lending in a derivative manner, lending people money to buy the stocks of stocks, to buy packages of other stocks that are packages of other loans, that became the business. And it spins around real fast, and each guy makes a big commission on it.
We're talking to Barbara Garson about her book, Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession. You interviewed a number of kind of Wall Street types, and it brought up a very interesting question, which is the word value, how they use the word value and what it means, how we use it and what it means.
Oh, yeah. You know, it took me a long time to get used to the notion of investor value, that just meant money, that they can buy a company and shake the money out of it and discard it. And as long as they've got the cash, I invested in a company that bought into the British railroads when they were being privatized. This isn't a money makes the world go around. And they did so. They came to us at a meeting. I'm not high enough to go to those meetings, but I also used my husband's company as if I was a reporter from there. And I would go to those meetings, and they would explain how the British Railroad is being privatized into lots of segments. And one guy will own the tracks, and one guy will own the rolling stock. And you remember that caused a lot of huge crashes in the British Railroad after it was privatized. That was a Thatcher result. But he said, we are buying the stations. And he said, because no one has noticed that a lot of valuable land is in that package. And we bought it. I say we. And we sold it off immediately and got humongous amount of cash. And afterwards, the British railroads renationalized because the result was so terrible. But and we bought, gave our section back, but we had made a huge amount of cash that went to us stockholders. That was more than the value of everything we bought by selling off pieces. Or sometimes you can just fire a lot of people and make a lot of money at once. It may be detrimental long term, but you're going to be out of the stock very quickly. So, yes, there are a lot of things that are in the short run are good for individual stockholders that are just very bad for, quote, the economy.
So we've seen the different ways through your book that this is basically a series of gigantic pyramid schemes and Ponzi schemes and bubbles that are just getting ready to burst all the time. And
right, I wonder if it's going to happen to the student loan bubble.
Yeah. Right. I mean, that's a whole other show that we could do, but there's apparently no loyalty on the part of corporations to their employees, no matter how long and hard they've worked. In fact, they try to push out senior people and so on. Is there, that you saw in all the time that you spent doing this book, is there any type of career path that is secure and stable?
Well, guarding, when the rich are getting rich and the poor are getting poorer, guarding is always a good job. I don't know if it's a career path, but it's a good area to get into. I mean, you're going to, whether your path is steady or not, there's going to be a lot of money in whether you're guarding in a military way or guarding by making locks and so on. It's always a good business in a very unequal country. So I don't know about a secure I'm sorry, I wish I could give personal advice. I only can say that the life I always chose, I've always been a freelance writer. And about every 10 years, and all my friends, I was in the free speech movement, and my friends went off to universities, and occasionally they'd invite me to speak. And about every 10 years, I said to myself, I can't keep doing this. I can't live as a freelance writer. And I'd examine the possibility of getting a regular job, you know, at a university or something. And personally, I didn't like it. As I got closer, I backed away. I'm sorry to say that the skills I picked up along the way turn out to be, you know, as good as many of my friends as apparently solid jobs. I don't know how to give you advice about a solid job.
So what do you think is the solution? I mean, is this a moral crisis? Is this a policy crisis? What is to be done?
It is a moral crisis, and they've got us into a crazy bind where we're thinking there's only one way to run an economy: give money to rich people and they'll invest it and do something for you. Well, they can't.
And they don't want to.
Well, they don't want to, but I try to keep out of that in my book. Now, that may be because only nice people would agree to be interviewed by me. But whether they're bad or good, if you're at the top of the company, you have to work for the short-term interests of that company. And right now, the short-term interests of those companies are against the long-term interests of the rest of the world. So we have to take the power away from them to decide what to do. Because, you know, what to do with the capital, what to do with our labor, what to do with the stuff in the world. First of all, they can't keep eating all this. They can't use up all the stuff. And it's never been as important as before to have some kind of social, democratic basis for your planning. Because right now we could destroy the whole planet if people just keep, you know, producing as much as they can in the short term. So I think it's time to think about some kind of socialism and not some kind of redistribution and production for use. And that's a moral question. I think Occupy half. Do you remember before Occupy, you couldn't even talk about the fact that money was unbalanced in some hands and not others, because the answer to that was, well, yes, and if we better give them more or they won't make jobs for us. At least we cleared away that notion that if they get more, they'll make the jobs for us. Now we have to figure out, so, okay, how are we going to make the jobs for ourselves? How are we going to start running industries and restaurants? restaurants like yours. And, you know, how are we going to start deciding in a more democratic way what to do with all our efforts? And if it's necessary, you know, perhaps we do have to work much fewer hours and still have the same buying possibilities, because 2% of the people are producing all the food we need in this country, and it's getting to be something like that with industry. No, not down to 2%, but it's getting more and more productive. So that means thinking for ourselves how to run it. I hope on some collective, I hope starting in small-scale ways, I mean, as a demonstration, but I don't think that's where it can end.
In your book, you talk about the website that you have for the book, downtheupescalator.com, and you have follow-up stories of the people whom we meet in the book, and it seems like, and also you say this in the book, I mean, it was emotionally very engaging and sometimes upsetting for you to write about these folks and follow their lives. There's this poignant moment where you burst into tears when you're talking to one of the people you're interviewing, because here you spend all this time writing books and they don't help anyone. Do you think that's really true?
I'm talking to a person who I was in the courtroom that morning to hear somebody else, and I hear the judge say to her, she asked him, when will this happen, Your Honor? When are they coming? And she said, he said, the house belongs to them. And he was very impatient. And he was right to be impatient with her. She tried every kind of ruse to keep on her, you know. I mean, legally she was in the wrong. But here was a woman who had actually owned her house, a black woman in Richmond, California, who owned her own private fourth-floor house that she bought for $35,000. And then years later, when this mortgage hustling started, she remortgaged her house in order to get down payments for her children to have houses. And then her son died, and, well, all kinds. Her son was killed, actually, in an unsolved murder. So she's tried everything, and she hasn't been entirely efficient about it. I mean, she knows nothing legal. She hears a half a word and thinks she can go off in this direction or that direction. They're finally coming. And I'm having dinner with her that evening. And she has no idea when they're going to come. She's saying things like, I hear the sheriff holds on to his stuff for 10 days before they throw it out. Whether that's true or not, she didn't know, and I didn't know. And where it would go after that, who knew? And she thanked me. She actually thanked me for listening to her. Well, that's when I really burst into tears. Because, right, I mean, you think... my book is not going to do her any good, and I'm going to fly away the next day. And I mean, I said to her, oh, I'm sorry, I'm upset because my books never do anyone any good. She was a home health care worker, and she said, oh, I know what you mean, because all my patients die. Well, it's true, her patients eventually die. She's called in at the last minute. I'm not sure that... Certainly my books don't do any good to the individuals that I talk to. If they do some good in understanding the whole thing, well, it's operating slowly.
Barbara Garson is a journalist, playwright, and author. Her new book is Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.